From WBUR Boston and WRNI Providence, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Elizabeth Smart is miraculously back in her parents' arms tonight, but highly publicized child abduction cases like hers have instilled a bone-deep fear in American parents and left many American children growing up in a tight cocoon of wall-to-wall family security inconceivable a generation ago. Fewer kids walk to the corner store or play in the park without a parent's watchful eye anymore. No one makes light of concern for child safety, but do we have the balance right? And how will our highly safety-conscious culture affect our children in the long run? Tonight on Point, fear, facts, and the child security state. We begin with NPR's Howard Berkus, who's been covering the Elizabeth Smart case in Salt Lake City, Utah. I asked him to give us the latest developments in the case.
There are a couple of interesting new developments. First of all, National Public Radio learned today that the mayor of Salt Lake City may conduct an investigation of the police investigation. The mayor's spokesman tells me that the mayor shares some of the Smart family's concerns that this man who is now in jail and was found with Elizabeth Smart yesterday was not as much a focus of the police investigation as he should have been. In fact, just earlier this week, just a couple of days ago, the Smart family had complained that police weren't putting enough effort into trying to find this man.
This is Brian Mitchell.
This is Brian Mitchell, the itinerant preacher who, it appears, was in Smart's company now for the past 9 months. And the mayor, Mayor Rocky Anderson, shares the concerns that the Smart family has expressed. And I'm told by the mayor's spokesman that they'll be looking into those concerns and that the investigation probably will end up being reviewed.
But Elizabeth Smart is home now.
She's home. The family says she's safe. She's been watching videos. She slept in her own bed last night, the same bed she was kidnapped from last June. She's been playing with her brothers and sisters. She's been sitting in her mother's lap.
It really does seem like a miracle story.
It does. You know, to be honest with you, I think many of us reporters who had covered the kidnapping had given up hope. And you heard even in the words of family members, even though they said, "We still believe she's alive," it didn't seem that they really believed that. And that's because this doesn't happen this way very often. It's unusual for there to be a child missing for so long to be returned, you know, relatively safe and sound.
Howard, in a TV interview this morning, Elizabeth's father, Ed Smart, said that he thought she had been through some kind of brainwashing. Why do you think he might have said that? Any news related to that?
Well, I asked him that at the news conference this morning, and all he said was is that he believed that that was the case, but he didn't have any specific information about that. He just believed she had been brainwashed. And he also noted that he's not pressing her for a lot of details. She is revealing some things voluntarily, but he's not pressing her, and he's leaving that to the police. I think he said that because a question has arisen about how it is that she was, you know, in this man's company for the last 9 months, sometimes within blocks of her own home, once for a week within a block of the police station at an apartment, and didn't try to escape, apparently, didn't yell out for help. The family, I think, believes that he must have had her under some sort of control to keep her from trying to get away.
What do we know about Brian Mitchell and his wife, Wanda? Is it Barzee? He's described as a kind of street charismatic.
Well, charismatic may be overdoing it because the homeless advocates I've talked to who know him well and know other street people well say that he wasn't very well liked by the other street people. But he saw himself as a preacher. He believed he was God, I'm told. One theory is that he allegedly kidnapped Elizabeth Smart because he was interested in having additional wives or additional followers. Wanda, his wife, was apparently his only follower. He's described as somebody who wasn't very pleasant to be around, was not well-liked by other people, was a loner, and was very steadfast in his belief that he was God.
But he was not a suspect, or at least if he was, it wasn't followed up on very rigorously.
This is one of the key pieces of key questions, I guess, about this whole thing that has surfaced more today and is becoming a bit of an embarrassment for the Salt Lake City police. Ed Smart said it again today. Why, he asked, hadn't the police focused more attention on this man sooner? In fact, in October, Elizabeth Smart's younger sister, who had witnessed the kidnapping, said that this man appeared to be the guy who did it.
This had been a handyman around the Smart home at some point.
At one point, he had been panhandling. The family felt sorry for him, brought him in to help repair a roof. That was a couple of years ago. And they've done that with many people. Homeless people have come and helped out. People down on their luck have been hired to do things around the house. So he was somebody who was familiar with the house and with Elizabeth. And the sister knew what he looked like. And after months and months of the family sort of constantly asking her, is there anything else? One day in October, she said, yes, I think it might have been that guy, Emmanuel. Now, they didn't figure out who Emmanuel was, and they didn't have a picture of him identified really until relatively recently, until last month.
And this was Brian Mitchell's street name, I guess.
That's what he called himself, right, Emmanuel. And it was only after pictures were located, he was identified, that people started coming forward and said, hey, I know that guy. I've seen that guy. And it was the Smart family getting that information out, not the police. It was the Smart family that really pressed for that. The police seemed to be stuck on a theory that this kidnapping was the result of another handyman at the Smart household who actually died in August. Police seemed to be sticking with that theory and didn't raise the possibility that this Emmanuel would be a suspect to the level of concern that the Smart family believed should have been done. And, you know, we now know in hindsight, of course, that that was a huge, huge mistake.
So some significant mysteries here, some anger around the way it was handled. But overall, in Salt Lake City, in the last day and a half, it must have been an incredibly buoyant feeling, Howard Berkus.
My daughter came home from school yesterday after hearing the news. She's 10 years old, and she bursts into the door, and she goes, Daddy, Daddy, they found her. They found Elizabeth. She's okay. And you heard that over and over again all over the city yesterday. I've gotten emails from people all over the country saying, you know, that's terrific, how wonderful they found her. People are talking about it everywhere you go. There are blue balloons and blue ribbons tied everywhere around the city. Blue was Elizabeth Smart's favorite color. There are posters everywhere that say, welcome home, Elizabeth. Thank you, God. People are really buoyant, especially in a time when it appears we may be going to war. People have said this is one wonderful thing that has happened in what is otherwise a difficult time.
It lifts the weight from the heart, even if we didn't know her. Howard Berkus, thank you so much for joining us tonight.
Thank you, Tom.
Howard Berkus is a correspondent for NPR. He spoke with us earlier from Salt Lake City, Utah. We are raising a generation of kids who will never be able to tell their own children that they walked 10 miles in the snow to school. In fact, how many will be able to say they walked alone to the bus stop? Whiled away whole childhood days far from the parental eye, a culture of high child security rules much of America. Parents chauffeur their kids to and from school, dole out cell phones to keep track of 11-year-olds, and ensure children's days are scheduled for adult supervision 24/7. And who can blame them when we hear the terrifying stories of kidnappings like Elizabeth Smart's, taken from her own bedroom on a warm summer night? American parents have grown habitually vigilant, maybe even paranoid. Do we have the balance right? And what's the impact of unending security consciousness on our kids? We'll be joined tonight by crime and child safety experts and by the ultimate child-rearing guide, Dr. T. Barry Brazelton. You can join the conversation as well. How many minutes a day is your child not under the watchful eye of some adult? Do your children have the same freedom to roam, explore, and freely grow that you had as a child? Can they today? How has our flight to child security changed childhood and parenthood in America? You can join the conversation tonight at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Joining me now is Peter Banks, Director of Training and Outreach for the National Center for Missing and Exploited Children. He joins us from Herndon, Virginia. Good evening and welcome, Peter Banks.
Good evening, Tom.
And joining us from Boston tonight is Jack Levin, director of the Brudnick Center on Violence and Conflict at Northeastern University. Good evening and welcome, Jack Levin.
Thank you very much.
Thanks to you both for being with us. It is an extraordinarily happy day in Salt Lake City, Utah, and that joy is felt right across the country in the way that we are now, in a media age, all plugged into to joy and terror when it occurs around children or anything else. But Peter Banks, walk us through, if you would, the numbers around child abduction. We thought it's a good opportunity, with a happy story in hand, to look at this whole scene tonight of child abduction, child security, child insecurity, and ask if we've got the right balance of cocoon around our kids. What do the numbers tell us about how vulnerable children are?
Well, you know, Tom, it is certainly more palatable for us to describe as the worst nightmare of a parent, the boogeyman, the guy under the bridge with the long raincoat, the hooked nose, and the wart. But the truth of the matter is that, you know, these occurrences are rare occurrences, that most children, when they are victimized, that someone has gotten legitimate access to the child.
And what do you mean by legitimate access?
Well, such as in a position of authority or as a position of friendship or a neighbor or a relative.
So not swooping down out of the blue.
You know, that is not the greatest threat to our kids. It's the numbers are there. The numbers bear out. And when we talk about kids that are abducted by what we call non-family members, you know, there's only about 5,000 cases a year. Of those 5,000, about 4,700 children a year are returned within 24 hours. So that leaves about 300 cases in which children are gone for long periods of time. And of those 300, there's about 100 cases a year where children are murdered. Now, there are 62 million children in America. 100 is not a big number, of course, unless it's your child, you know, and then it is a huge number. And I would submit to you that, you know, this case has done more than just fill the hearts of Elizabeth and the Smart family in Salt Lake City and the children. This gives hope to every parent of every missing child, kids that have been gone for 13 years, like Jacob Wetterling, or for 6 years, like Morgan Nick, or for 1,000 days, like Molly Bish in Boston. In the Boston area. So this is the hope upon which every parent of every missing child lives.
It surely is, and it lifts everybody's heart. Jack Levin, when you hear these numbers, as a man who looks at crime and the meaning of crime and ways to address crime, what do they tell you? On the one hand, any single case of the abuse of a child, let alone the murder, I mean, it's terrible, and it weighs on us almost infinitely. At the same time, We can wrap our kids in so much security that part of childhood itself is lost. What's your sense of the numbers and how American parents balance security in the lives of their children?
Well, you know, Peter is absolutely right. The numbers are small. The probability is tiny that any given child is going to be abducted and then murdered by a stranger. At the same time, numbers are not everything. Mm-hmm. And in the case of Elizabeth Smart, you have to remember that she was literally snatched from her own bed in the middle of the night, from a safe haven, from her own home, in a middle-class neighborhood. You know, Elizabeth Smart could be anybody's daughter, and it makes us feel very fearful, even if the numbers are small. The idea, this was not street crime. This didn't happen in a crime-ridden neighborhood. And it wasn't a hooker. It wasn't a prostitute who was gone missing.
It was a 14-year-old girl in her own family home. But is there an epidemic?
But that's my point. It doesn't have to be an epidemic. Absolutely, there is no epidemic here. But when you hear about a story where a young girl is snatched from a safe haven, then, you know, it just incites fear way beyond what the numbers would dictate, and I think that has to be factored in. It's not just the quantity, it's also the quality of crime that makes a difference in terms of our thinking about it.
So it's clearly not just a case of volume, and yet we're trying to find that right balance tonight of security awareness for our children on a happy day in Salt Lake City, a day that the whole country celebrates. But does your child have the same freedoms you had as a child? Has our hyper-security consciousness around children changed the quality of childhood? You can join us tonight at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-8255. 1-800-423-TALK. What is the right balance? I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point on the day that Salt Lake City and much of the nation celebrates the return of Elizabeth Smart to her family. We are talking tonight about finding the right balance in security awareness for our children. Do you let your child walk to the town center alone, to the park, the bus stop, to the end of the block? How many minutes a day is your child not supervised by an adult? Do children of the supervised society grow up to be a different kind of adult? Have we got the balance right? We're at 1-800-423-8255. My guests tonight are Peter Banks. He's Director of Training and Outreach for the National Center for Missing and Exploited Children. And from Boston, Jack Levin, Director of the Brudnick Center on Violence and Conflict at Northeastern University. Peter Banks, what about this question of family behavior around the issue of security, families with children? You must have tracked this or have a sense of it. My personal observation in the world is that family life is very different than it was a generation ago, that children's lives have been, to an enormous extent, cocooned by the supervision and observation of adults. Am I right about that? Have people changed the way they live?
They have changed the way they live, and quite often the responses have been, not very appropriate. And we get people that call us, and they want to install GPSs in their kids, and they want to, tattoo numbers on them and everything else. It's some really incredible ideas have come out of this fear. And, if I can just expand on what Jack said, this is the greatest nightmare is someone breaking into your home and stealing your child. And that not only harms that child, but it destroys the quality of life for every child in that community.
You mean when it happens?
When it happens.
And today our whole country is a community in the sense that the media is there, but there are many areas of life in which we try not to build our life entirely around nightmare scenarios.
At one hand, you worry about your child and everything like that, but parents have no qualms in to let their child go upstairs and sit in their room for 8 hours by themselves and surf the internet, which is just about allowing for an electronic home invasion, without proper guidance, allowing kids to go out there in Cyberville, which is a city and town like any place else in America. And so we have to really understand what we have to arm, the information we have to arm our children with to protect them in most situations. We don't want to make them so fearful, give them the wrong information. Some kids have the home alone syndrome, where they think that because they've had a couple of karate classes, they can, defend themselves physically against an attacker, or they come up with some unpredictable scenario, that is so remote, like, being thrown in the trunk of a car and, being told what to do then. We need to arm our kids with the right information about the majority of the times that they can get victimized. And by doing that, we arm them with the best weapon they can use to protect themselves, which is self-esteem and telling your kids you love them and you care about them, that they make you happy, that they make you proud. We'll do more to protect your child than all the other alarms, because that is the way that children are victimized today.
Jack Levin, what's your sense? What's your observation? Do you share the perception that the quality of childhood has changed in some substantial degree through the cocoon of security that families now weave around their children through the constant supervision and surveillance of kids? And is that fully appropriate?
Well, no, it isn't. More and more parents are trying to find high-tech ways of supervising their children because they can't personally do it. We just have more than half of all our teenagers and children grow up without full-time parental supervision. They come home after school to an empty house, and there are many other times during the week when they're alone. So in schools, we put in more metal detectors and resource cops in the hallways and put security cameras in, and we're trying to do that throughout society to make up for that difference.
So are you saying we're too protective or not protective enough?
Well, it's too bad that we can't do it ourselves, that we have to depend upon law enforcement to do what we probably should be doing as adults and getting involved in the lives of our youngsters. Of course, that's not going to make all the difference. In the area of terrorism, the president says, be vigilant. Well, maybe we ought to do the same thing about our children. Be vigilant, be watchful, use common sense, but don't get hysterical about this. We got hysterical about sharks the summer before last. We got hysterical about pit bulls the summer before that. It seems that every year we get hysterical about one phenomenon or another, and we don't solve the problem because we're hysterical.
And even to the degree that there's is a real problem here, is it appropriate for a parent to have such vigilance that they're always looking over that child's shoulder? You can join us tonight at 1-800-423-8255. Karen's calling from Sturgeon Bay, Wisconsin. Hi, Karen. You're on the air.
Hi. Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Good to have you.
I just want to say I really do agree with your speakers tonight, and I feel this so intensely.
In what dimension, Karen? In what aspect?
Well, I agree with them in that we should not put this on our children. We should not put the fear on our children. Empowering children is a different thing than putting fear on them. And I realize and I understand why you have those big boards with everybody's faces all over them. But it freaks the young people out. I mean, I have two children. It absolutely scares my daughter. You know, who are all these missing children? Where did they go? And they don't know that, you know, that...
The numbers are relatively small, as horrible as the cases may be.
Exactly. You know, that was stated at the beginning, that the numbers of people of children that are abducted by someone who is actually straight is 100 in...
Well, 100 who die, I think it was 300.
300.
Well, 5,000 total, most back by the next day, 300 not, and 100 dead. I mean, these are not pretty numbers, and yet we need to keep a sense somehow of balance here. Karen, what about your parenting style? Is it different from your own parents? Are your children living a more cocooned life, security-wise, than you did?
Absolutely. I mean, I don't live in a city. I live in a very small town. But I remember when I was a child, I used to explore. Like, we would just go into town and we'd be gone all day. And we'd come back for lunch if we were hungry. I mean, we would just be out and about.
How big is your town, Karen?
We have a small town, but in the summer we get a big influx of tourists. And so now there is this
strangers.
Sort of, ooh, I don't trust the people who don't live here. You know, in the winter it's just us. I mean, we have like maybe 4,000 people in
and
our
yet town. I would guess that even when you were a kid there were tourists as well.
There were, absolutely. I mean, we used to play SWAT team and follow them and harass them to endless amounts.
Do you think your children are losing something by not having that kind of freedom? And do you just feel, would you feel irresponsible giving it to them today?
Absolutely. I would. And it's a quandary that I'm in as a mother. But the thing is, you know, he mentioned having that home alone syndrome. You know, if you take a taekwondo course,
right.
You feel like... You know everything. However, in our town, we did have an excellent, it was called Power Kids Taekwondo program, and we actually had an incredible success story. There was a girl who was, you know, somebody slowed their car and opened up his door and said, hey, come on in here with me. And she was a power girl, so she said no. You know, she actually did what she was taught to do, and she said it loudly, and she put her hands out. She says, no, you're not my father. I don't know you, so that everyone around her would know.
That's right by the book, A Karate Chop to the Shadows of the World there.
Exactly. She was just, and then she ran. And you know, I mean, we had a party for her. We're like, you win. You know,
well, that's a good story, and yet we feel the way in which you and I'm sure others are torn, Karen, when you think about how to raise those kids. I want to turn now to Dr. T. Barry Brazelton. He's one of the country's best-known child development experts, pediatrician, author of 32 books. His latest are Calming the Fussy Baby, Sleep and Discipline the Brazelton Way. Good evening and welcome, T. Barry Brazelton.
Hi.
Thank you for joining us tonight. You've no doubt seen the news in the last day and a half about Elizabeth Smart. I'm sure you've paid attention.
Oh, gosh.
To this story, to the media stories about abductions in general, and I'm sure also to the longer-term trends in American parenting when it comes to supervision and security around children. What do you see happening there, Barry Brazelton, and what do you make of it? Is it a good thing?
Well, I don't think it's a matter of whether it's a good thing or not. We're stuck with it. And it's sort of like I've been running into around the country. Parents are under 12 more pressures than we were when we were raising our children. And this means that the escalation of anxiety in both parents and children is enormous. since 9/11, no parent can promise their child a safe future. You know, every child in America has been affected by that. Mm-hmm. And now with this threat of war, that's another escalation. Mm-hmm. And, of course, reading about Elizabeth is another one. So our kids are really burdened. I think it's tragic what they're having to face as they grow up. Oh. And I couldn't agree more with Karen and your two experts that we as adults ought to be looking for solutions and trying to assume them. It's not a child's job to protect themselves. And, you know, up until they're 6 or 7, mm-hmm. they have to learn to trust people. Mm-hmm. How are they learning to trust anybody?
But when you look at the way that Americans parent today, how do you assess the balance, the ratio of vigilance and paranoia? Do people get it roughly right by your lights, or do they go overboard? And, you know, when the child can't walk to the end of the block, essentially has adult eyes nearly on every possible moment? Is it the right balance or not?
I think it's very hard, and I'm sure it's very individual. You know, parents have got to make up their own minds how they're going to do it. As a pediatrician, I can warn parents that there is a syndrome called hovering, a vulnerable child syndrome of hovering over a child and not allowing them to learn to face what they have to learn to face. Mm-hmm. And I would worry a lot about that. I think by the time they're 7 or 8, we've got to teach them coping strategies. I love the story about that little girl that clopped the guy.
You're not my father.
You're not my father, and screamed her head
right.
off. Those are wonderful techniques. And I think if, you know, the other thing, as she talked about it, I thought it's wonderful for kids to learn that in a group. Because mm-hmm. then it takes the sort of individual pressure off them.
Yes.
And if all the other kids are learning that too, you know, it doesn't feel so so abnormal.
Barry Breselton, what's your sense of how this generation, and maybe we're into a second generation now of American children growing up under this kind of bubble of high security consciousness, does it change the kind of adults that they become?
Oh, I'm sure it does. We're under a terrible head of steam, and mothers and fathers ask me, am I pushing my kids? And I say, sure, you're pushing yourself. And we're raising kids who are pushing themselves. So, yeah, we're raising a very different generation.
What do you expect it will mean in terms of that, the character of that generation, the way it lives, the way it exercises citizenship? Can you draw lines? Can you anticipate behavior?
Well, I think we are seeing a lot of it. Yeah, I think attentional disorders are increasing, PDD, all sorts of disorders like that are increasing.
And you connect that to security consciousness somehow, or vigilance around children, or fear?
Well, I think we could increase it to the increase in anxiety that these kids are being raised with and raised in. And, you know, kids aren't playing these days. They're watching TV, or they're in front of video games. And play is where a child learns about himself, learns about other people, learns about how to get along. And we're losing a lot of that. I think we're in the midst of a real crisis.
But maybe we're losing some of that play because parents don't feel free to let their kids run out in the world and climb a tree.
Well, I agree with you, and I think it does push. I see my own daughters and having to make play dates all the time and rush to put them into play dates. Mm-hmm. Maybe that's the only way so far, but I think all of us ought to be looking for innovative new ideas about how to give children back their childhood. We've really taken it away from them.
Dr. T. Barry Breselton, stand by. Pete's calling from Boston. Hi, Pete. You're on the air.
Hey, thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I guess I have a little bit of a contrary point. I mean, mm-hmm. I'm a stay-at-home dad.
Okay.
And I'm raising 2 daughters.
Good.
Great.
And definitely my daughters do not have anywhere near the freedom I had. I might have had 4 or 5 free hours in a day.
Mm-hmm.
And
then?
10 minutes, I would say 10 minutes of I don't know where they are is too long for me.
Mm-hmm.
But I do have to say that I feel much more involved than I think my parents were. I mean, I run a brownie troop. I'm involved, you know, with their swimming program. I meet all the parents they play with. I'm involved at a much deeper level than definitely my parents ever were. That's and it's not out of fear. It's just that I really want to know what's going on.
Well, so you raise a couple of issues here. And Peter Banks, Jack Levin, I know you're there as well, but this one goes so much to Barry Brazelton's turf. Pete, let me raise this. I guess on the one hand, here Pete's very involved, not out of security consciousness in his case, but many parents have become more involved, sometime because of security consciousness. Is parenting changing too somehow in the environment we face now?
Absolutely. Absolutely. It's changed. And Peter, I'd say you have compensated. Those are lucky little girls. There is a study out of Washington that shows that if parents are involved in their children's education, either as a coach or as in the PTA, those kids are significantly less likely to get into peer pressure in adolescence. So you're doing for those kids what you need to, not only now, but for the future.
Peter Banks, I want to invite you, and you're hearing the conversation, both in our callers' observations and the observations of Barry Brazelton. Where does it leave you thinking about this balance of security, involvement, and the freedom for children to grow, explore, roam?
You know, when I was a kid, I was thinking back, Tom, when I was a kid, we had intergenerational relationships. My friends were the sons and daughters of my parents' friends. My mother had a system that would put the CIA to shame. I never had to tell her what I did. She knew everybody, and everybody raised me.
Right.
My grandma lived up the street. My aunt lived across a block, and a felony was cutting across Mr. Kutzak's lawn. You know, that was
Watch out. You're
restricted for a week. But, you know, as Pete in Boston is talking, I mean, he is providing for the child. He has a luxury of having one parent raising the child, and I think there's some decisions that need to be made as far as where our priorities are. And you know, sometimes the priorities are in careers, and sometimes they're in families. That is where I see a significant difference in today, as opposed to the last generation.
And Jack Levin, is it then irresponsible parenting when a parent lets their child walk to the town center, play by the creek all day without knowing they are for more than 10 minutes?
Well, there's no way in the world that we can control every aspect of our children's lives. But I think that to depend upon the kind of neighborliness and parenting that Peter Banks had as a child, and he's lucky to have had it, just is not going to do it. I think all adults have got to feel a sense of social responsibility for what happens to our youngsters. In Boston, for example, over the last 10 years, there have been more community centers open, boys and girls clubs, after-school programs, summer jobs generated by private industry and the government. And that means that our kids have been supervised, maybe not by their own parents. I mean, Pete in Boston is an exception to the rule. It's a terrific exception, and he's a role model for what more parents can do. But if we leave it up to all the parents out there who are working full time or who are divorced,
it's tough to balance. We've got to take a short break. Jack Levin, please stand by. We're talking about finding the right balance in security awareness for our children tonight. We're at 1-800-423-8255. This is On Point. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight on the day after the release and return home of Elizabeth Smart about finding the right balance and security awareness for our children. Does your child have the same freedoms you had as a child? Do you let your child walk to the town center alone, to the park, the bus stop, to the end of the block? Are American families overprotective of their children or just doing what's necessary? You can join us tonight at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. We're joined tonight from Virginia by Peter Banks. He's a former Washington, D.C. police officer, supervisor of the Child Abuse Unit there, and now director of training and outreach for the National Center for Missing and Exploited Children. By Jack Levin, director of the Brudnick Center on Violence and Conflict at Northeastern University. And by Dr. T. Barry Brazelton, one of the country's best-known pediatricians and child development experts. You can join the conversation as well. Lisa's on the line. Welcome, Lisa. You're on the air.
Hi. I wanted to make a few points. Number one, I came from Russia 22 years ago.
Okay.
I raised two children to the age of 12 and 14 in Russia. And by the age of 11, they were able to stay home. They were able to completely protect themselves. They knew exactly where to go, what to do. They were allowed to take public transportation and go to places in the city, in St. Petersburg.
So you're saying they had more freedom than
right,
American children you observe?
Right, they did. My 11-year-old son, who was, grandson, who was born here, mm-hmm, doesn't know how to go to the nearby like corner store about 100 yards and how to buy a can of soda.
So, Lisa, do you think that your grandchild is being raised in a way that's too fearful, too protected, or is this necessary?
Yes. Well, I think it is too fearful, too protective, and I actually think that we are depriving children from learning vital skills necessary for survival, and we are depriving them of some quality of life, some experiencing, from experiencing life, actually.
Yeah, I sometimes
right
fear you're exactly right, Lisa. Stay with us. I want to put this to Dr. Brazelton. T. Barry Brazelton, how about it? It's the same point, but it's hard to shake. Are we so freaked out by the reports of abductions across a country of, 285 million people now, that the life of every child or many child becomes unnecessarily constrained and hemmed in?
Yeah, I think she may be right, that maybe what we've got to change from is a country that felt safe and felt like we were protected and we could raise our children in a safe environment, to one that we aren't safe anymore. And we've raised the bar, so to speak. And maybe now we ought to be concentrating on teaching our kids skills about how to take care of themselves. I love Mr. Banks's idea that, you know, you really instill self-esteem and the capacity to master these things in children way back when they're little and from the first.
Mm-hmm.
And I think maybe along with these skills that we've heard from Karen and from
Lisa here,
Peter, yeah, they were wonderful. That we've got to give them enough self-esteem so they feel like I can take care of myself.
But self-esteem goes on developing. Does it get damaged or stunted when a 6-year-old child, an 8-year-old child, 9-year-old child can't go to the end of the block alone?
Well, I hope not, because that's the way a lot of people have to live these days. And I think those people really need to be looking for how do I give my child a feeling of resilience, of being in charge of my world. And I don't think we can do it using the media or using the kind of techniques that we've been sort of shoved into at this point. So I think we ought to be looking for innovative new ways to do it.
But Jack Levin, do you think it's true that that's the way a lot of children have to live now? Or is this the outcome of an overdeveloped sense of threat, of vulnerability?
You know, we know one thing in criminology, if nothing else, and that is that there's a very tenuous relationship between fear of crime and the crime rate itself. Since 1993, we've seen the crime rate plummet in Boston, in New York City, in Chicago, Los Angeles, Houston. But the fear of crime remains high. Mm-hmm. There were missing children being murdered 10 years ago. There were missing children murdered 20 years ago. The murder rate is down, not up. The number of school murders committed by teenagers is actually down and was down at the time that the Columbine massacre occurred. Mm. So part of this is a constructed problem. We've created it for ourselves. Part of it, it's reality, and mm-hmm, I understand that.
Mm-hmm.
You know, as I said earlier in the program, when a youngster is snatched from her bed in the middle of the night, numbers tell you very little as to the reaction of parents around
right,
the country.
That's
but
right.
I think part of this really is an exaggeration. We could let our kids have more freedom. It concerns me that we don't, and that we've exaggerated the problem. And I don't want to blame the media for everything, and it's become fashionable to do so. But, you know, on a slow news day, people are going to talk about missing children or pit bulls or sharks or school massacres. It's inevitable.
It turns that head. Peter Banks, what about it? Do we have an historical perspective on this? Is it possible that 30 years ago, when children roamed neighborhoods and woods and parks and streams for whole days at a time, that the kidnapping rate or abduction rate was just as high as it is now, or was it dramatically lower then? Were they, in fact, safer then?
Well, of course, now we have far fewer children than we had a few years ago. We are seeing the numbers going down.
But I mean the sort of percentage of kids who got kidnapped every year, was it any higher or lower then? Do we know even? Maybe they didn't keep the statistics.
Well, the problem is identifying what we talk about. It's defining the abductions. A lot of the crimes that were reported are reported not as abductions but as murders or as rapes. There was where the police departments in the Uniform Crime Report try to when they get a case, what they do is they go with the most serious offense, and most of these kids were lured away and get victimized. It doesn't even count as an abduction. I would submit to you that we do have perhaps less abductions, but they're getting more violent, and they are reflective of what society is today. When we look at, we can give you examples from long ago where kids were taken away and held for long periods of time, where we didn't have the communications that we have now, where we can identify some of these children quickly and we can locate them even quicker using technology or using better communications.
So, but hard to make an apples to apples comparison, but possible that we have a degree of constructed problem here, to use Jack Levin's phrase. I want to thank Lisa from St. Petersburg long ago calling us earlier. I think you laid the situation out very clearly there between generations. Tracy's calling. Hi, Tracy. You're on the air.
Hi, how are you?
Fine, thanks.
First of all, I want to say that I love this show.
Oh, thanks.
And
so much.
Dr. Bradleton is my favorite pediatrician. I wish that I could really take my son to him, but he's booked, I guess.
Yes, writing the books anyway.
Yeah. Basically, what I was saying was that I guess I'm one of those parents who's paranoid, and I can't really say I blame the media for it. I think I've seen some things that kind of make me more vigilant.
Do you have a child or children, Tracy?
I do. I have one child.
How old, if I may ask?
Five
years old. And do you let him or her out of your sight? Five's pretty young.
Don't let him out of my sight. He is he's under surveillance of an adult 24 hours a day.
So how old do you think your son will have to be before you would send him, two or three blocks, to pick up the mail or you name it?
Probably
21?
18, I don't know. he'd have to be, bigger and able to defend himself. As a matter of fact, ever since he was 2 years old, we've taught him that if someone approaches him and tries to grab him, to scream and say, "I don't know this person, help me," run, And it's kind of sad because I do believe that, this is impacting his childhood. He can't be as free and, just have the sorts of freedoms that I had even as a child. And it's kind of, it's sad, but I want to know how to strike that balance. But I'm also very fearful.
Barry Breslin, lucky for Tracy, the doctor is in tonight. I mean, you hear the tension, the concern for the child, but also the concern about overprotectiveness. Counsel her.
I do, Tom, and I think we've left out one thing. I think we've been talking about what it means to parents and how they are passing on their concerns to their kids. But, we haven't talked about a way of helping those kids with the concerns that they're living with.
So what's your advice?
I think we need to talk to them more and to hear what is on their mind and how they feel about it. After 9/11, we went to New York a lot, and we learned that there are levels of ages at which children think. For instance, at the age of five, a child thinks, "I'm a bad kid, that's why they'd snatch me." Uh-huh. And when they get a little bit older,
it's my fault.
There are different ways of thinking about it, and I think we've got to really learn to listen to our kids and be ready to answer their questions, be ready to join them in the kind of concerns they have and share with them how we're facing our concerns. I've heard tonight some wonderful ways of dealing with the anxiety we all are living with, and I think those should be shared with kids. I think they would feel very comforted by some of the things that I've heard tonight.
And after they're listening, Barry Brazelton, what's the message we can give in return? You said very early in the show that after 9/11 we can't realistically tell them necessarily that they're safe, and yet day to day within a single home, within a child's orb of awareness, can't we say that? Should we say that? What should we say?
I think we can say what Peter and Jack have been saying, that we're all going to face it together. Mm-hmm. None of us are really very comfortable about any of this, but we're all thinking about it, and we all want to talk about it, and we're all right here together. This is a day for everybody to eat breakfast and supper with their kids, mm-hmm. have special times that they go out and discuss things like this, not over the phone or mm-hmm. in another room or something, mm-hmm. but have a time when you go out with your child every weekend and talk about it all week long. And then when you get out, say, you know, let's talk about what you're worried about. I'll tell you what I'm worried about.
What would you tell a child about the Elizabeth Smart story, Dr. Barry Brazelton? Many children will have heard about it from the radio, the TV, exactly. You name it. What's the message there?
I would say to them, what do you know about it? And, you know, and then they'd say, oh, I hear she got snatched away. Well, you know, I did too, and it scared me. But you know what we're doing? We're going to watch carefully, and we're going to be careful about not being sure, not ever leaving you alone to be snatched away as much as we can. And I'd share it with them and share the anxiety with them.
Tracy, there's your answer straight from the doctor's mouth. Jack Levin, we do not escape the tension this hour between that desire to let them have freedom and that sense that we want to assure them we will be with them.
Well, you know, the point of balance is always shifting, and we've got to find a comfortable place for ourselves and our family and our children. I think Barry Brazelton is right. This is kind of an individual decision that has to be made. It means having good judgment, exercising that good judgment, showing common sense, not getting hysterical, not being paranoid, giving our kids a sense of security that is realistic. Mm-hmm. And I know that there are many people out there who are doing exactly that. They may be uncomfortable with it, but they're doing the best they can, and I think that's all we can ask.
Well, it's been a fascinating hour, and I thank each and every one of you. Jack Levin, director of the Brudnick Center on Violence and Conflict at Northeastern University in Boston, thank you very much for being with us this hour.
Thank you.
Thanks, Tom.
And Dr. T. Barry Brazelton, it's been a pleasure. I hope you'll come and visit us again. We can use your advice these days. Thanks so much for joining us tonight.
Great. Great to talk to you.
Dr. T. Barry Brazelton is one of the country's best-known pediatricians and child development experts, author of 32 books. His latest are Calming the Fussy Baby, Sleep, and Discipline, the Brazelton Way. And Peter Banks in Herndon, Virginia, thank you very much for being with us tonight.
Thank you, Tom.
Peter Banks is a former Washington, D.C. police officer and was supervisor of the child abuse unit there. He's now director of training and outreach for the National Center for Missing and Exploited Children. You can continue the conversation online at onpointradio.org. Click on forums. On Point is produced by Meghna Chakrabarty, Eileen Imada, Virginia Prescott, John Roberts, James Ross, Keith Shields, Karen Schiffman, and Tim Skog, with help from Sabi Mir. Our senior producer is Graham Griffith. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.
This is WB.